Welcome to Canada's most irreverent talk show. This is The Andrew Lawton Show, brought to you by True North.
Hello and welcome to you all. Happy belated Easter. He is risen. It is a delight to have you on the show. Watching the show. I mean, maybe you're on the show. If Chris Sims is watching, she's on the show today. So that line was true in that context. We'll also be speaking later on to Peter Sean Taylor, who is a senior features editor with C2C Journal, has a great piece on housing and why, no, the issues with the housing situation in Canada are not that it is racist or white supremacists or anything like that. So we'll talk to him later on about that piece. And that's not a straw man, by the way. The federal government's appointed housing advocate has been making those very claims about the housing landscape in this country. Also want to talk in a little bit about this, a big to-do yesterday where you had people across the country protesting. I think in Alberta, one of my colleagues said they're still protesting out there against the federal carbon tax, specifically the increase in the carbon tax went up by 23% yesterday. So it was no April Fool's Day joke. The world has gotten more expensive, at least insofar as Canada is concerned. We have the price of gasoline that's gone up, the price of home heating, if you have natural gas that's gone up, you have the price of fuel in general has gone up in price, and that means that anything that requires fuel, the oranges maybe you buy that are shipped in from Florida, that can of sardines or whatever, all of that has gotten more expensive. Oranges and sardines, I don't think you want to mix those. But all of those got more expensive yesterday, and it will still continue to trickle down. As the cost of fuel increases, so too does the cost of everything. This is the problem with it, is that it's not just that consumer carbon tax that you see as a line item on your gas bill. It's the way that tax is now embedded in the Canadian economy. Now, the federal government is obviously feeling some pressure here. We've seen the government get a very, very defensive about this. Stephen Guilbeault, he had a piece in the National Post where he says, why I think the carbon tax is the right policy for Canada. This is positioned as the federal environment minister responding to critics, and he's defending it. And the Liberals are still sticking to that line that, oh, everyone's getting better off. Everyone's better off here. You make more money than you spend, in which case, well, what is the point of the whole thing? This is a clip from Justin Trudeau once again turning around and making it out as though premiers are the problem and not him.
All those premiers that are busy complaining about the price on pollution but not putting forward a concrete alternative that they think would be better for their communities are just playing politics. Every province has the opportunity to put forward its own plan as long as they are fighting climate change to the same level that we're asking all other Canadians to do. That's what a federal backstop is. But we're not seeing detailed plans from the premiers on this. They'd much rather try to complain about it and make political hay out of this. But Canadians know we need to fight climate change. And we need to be supporting people with more money in their pockets. That's what the federal backstop does. That's what the Canada Carbon Rebate that's landing in people's bank accounts as of April 15th is going to help them with. And that's a Canada Carbon Rebate, money in people's pockets, that Conservative politicians want to take away.
The premiers could just come up with their own plan if they have a better way of doing it. Except the problem is, and he kind of just buries it in an aside there, it's almost a parenthetical remark on Trudeau's part, that it has to meet the federal threshold, which means that provinces actually don't really get to opt out of this. They can come up with any plan they want as long as it looks and feels exactly like the federal government's plan. Unless you're Quebec. Quebec kind of gets a pass to do its own thing, and in the end actually has to charge consumers less. But that's just because for political reasons, the federal government will never look at Quebec and give it a fair shake compared to what the rest of the country is having to deal with. So we'll talk about all this shortly with our friend Chris Sims, who will join us in just a little bit of time. But this is actually a bit of breaking news here. Justin Trudeau gave a rare bit of honesty this morning at a political press conference. Now, this is not an April Fool's joke, by the way. No, he actually was candid and honest and frank about something, and this is on April 2nd. If he did it yesterday, I would have thought it might have been a deep fake, but he was very honest, and that issue, even more remarkably, was on immigration. We have seen housing in this country become a top issue for Canadians. We see it as being a very large part of why Pierre Poilievre is surging so much in the polls, because he's coming and talking about this issue when the Liberal government, with 9 years at the helm, have not actually been able to do all that much except for preside over a worsening of the situation. But Justin Trudeau was asked about this and a lot of the other stuff connected to it. And my, let's take a look.
You recently said your government is working on both housing supply and demand by turning the dial down on temporary immigration. Does that mean your government's immigration policy has contributed to record high housing unaffordability?
It's really important to understand the context around immigration. Every year, we bring in about 450, now close to 500,000 permanent residents a year. And that is part of the necessary growth of Canada. It benefits our citizens, our communities. It benefits our economy. These are the levels that we have stabilized and grown steadily over the past years, because that's what Canada needs to continue to have a strong economy and strong communities. However, over the past few years, we've seen a massive spike in temporary immigration, whether it's temporary foreign workers or whether it's international students in particular, that have grown at a rate far beyond what Canada has been able to absorb. To give an example, in 2017, 2% of Canada's population was made up of temporary immigrants. Now we're at 7.5% of our population comprised of temporary immigrants. That's something that we need to get back under control, both for the benefits of those people, but because international students we're seeing increasingly vulnerable to mental health challenges, to not being able to thrive and get the education they want, but also increasingly more businesses relying on temporary foreign workers in a way that's driving down wages in some sectors. So we want to get those numbers down. It's a responsible approach to immigration that continues on our permanent residents as we have, but holds the line a little more on the temporary immigration that has caused so much pressure in our communities.
So this was a long clip, but there was buried in it an incredibly important sentence, and I'm going to read that. We literally threw this in a moment ago, so I don't have the small highlight clip to share with you, but I'll read the line. Over the past few years, we've seen a massive spike in temporary immigration, whether it's temporary foreign workers or whether it's international students in particular, that have grown at a rate far beyond what Canada has been able to absorb. So Justin Trudeau is conceding two things in this. Number one, that there has been a massive spike in immigration. I mean, we know that. We look at the numbers. We see how Canada is ultimately bringing in upwards of 1 million people a year if you extend it beyond new permanent residents and also include these temporary residents in Canada who are TFWs, they're international students and the like. So we have this massive spike that Justin Trudeau concedes. And then the key part here is that it's grown at a rate far beyond what Canada has been able to absorb. Now, when he says Canada, he is talking about Canadians, Canadian societies, the Canadian labor market, the Canadian housing market. When he talks about immigration happening, he talks about it in this very passive way, as though it just happened. We just blinked one day and there are, this many more millions of people here. When his government has been in charge of immigration policy in Canada for the last 9 years. If there is an issue with an immigration system that has swelled to such a point that Canada cannot absorb the people, his words, not mine, it is his government that is to blame. So Justin Trudeau, for the first time, is admitting a profound failure on his and his government's part to manage immigration in a sustainable way. Now, one of the things you may know, it's been a part of True North's coverage. I asked Conservative leader Pierre Poilievre about this in December when I did a year-end interview with him. What's the Conservative number? What is the number that the Conservative Party, if it forms government, would use to base how many immigrants Canada can absorb, can sustain? And as you may recall, Poilievre in that interview would not give a firm number. I even tried the old just the number thing that he did to Jean Charest during the leadership. And he said, well, I'm not going to give you a number, but here's what we're going to do. We're going to tie it to jobs. We're going to tie it to housing. And there was something else. I think healthcare was the other one. We're going to tie it to jobs, housing, and healthcare. And he certainly said that the current number was not sustainable. Well, even Justin Trudeau is admitting this now. So we have here quite a significant development. Now, the federal government, of course, is not going to actually say that it is to blame for this. They're going to start using these incidental terms. Like, oh, it just sort of happened. Yeah, just this is why. And we just tweaked the system here. And I honestly feel, I mean, Mark Miller, who's the immigration minister, him and Justin Trudeau, those two guys are longtime friends. They have known each other for a long time. I think they're thick as thieves. So I don't expect there to be a real point of friction between the two. But if there were a different immigration minister, I would actually say that there would be. I would say that there would be some fracture there, that someone would have to in that role say, well, hold on. You're now saying that we have been the ones that have been responsible for the problems here. I mean, look, it's true. Like I said, this was a remarkable bit of honesty and candor from Justin Trudeau. And he talks about how we need to get it back under control. Back under control. And this is the problem. I mean, there was that story in Brampton, Ontario, a couple of weeks back where 25 people were living in one single house that had a couple of rental units. Most of them, if not all of them, were international students. We've seen the videos and the footage. I mean, Harrison Faulkner's talked about this on a show a number of times of people just lining up for jobs at grocery stores and other retail settings, lining up around the block, hundreds and hundreds of people looking for jobs. You order food delivery in a university a university town or a college town, and 9 times out of 10, it's an international student that is delivering it, because these are people that come to this country and then find they cannot succeed here because they can't find a job, they can't find a home, they can't do all of the things that they need to survive, or let alone thrive, in a country. So this idea that the system is broken is not new. In fact, Justin Trudeau may be the last person in Canada to wake up to the conclusion. He may be the last person here who's even realized that this simply is not working. But I will say, welcome to the party. It's nice of you to turn up. If you are coming, better late than never. Welcome to the reality that Canada and Canadians have been going through on your watch, Prime Minister. And when he says this was a massive spike, fact check, true. When he says it's more than Canada could absorb, fact check, true. Now, the hilarious irony in all of this is that if a Conservative politician were to have said what Justin Trudeau said in that clip that I just shared, they would be maligned by the Liberals as racist. They would be called anti-immigrant. They would be called xenophobic. But when the Liberals wake up to that point, when the Liberals say, because it's not a race issue, it's not a diversity issue, it's not even undermining the core thesis that, oh, diversity is our strength. It's simply saying that immigration in this country, at the very least, has to be tied to a country's ability to provide economically for the people who are within its borders, citizens and otherwise, which means if you can't deal with that, you cannot add to that without having there be a problem that the government needs to deal with. My apologies on the grammar there. I was getting fired up about this topic because it has always been treated as though it's the political third rail, where you can't have an honest and frank discussion about immigration. And the federal government, the Liberals, have been the primary purveyors of that sense. They've been the ones calling anyone who criticizes their immigration approach as racist. They've been the ones maligning those who want to raise these very issues that even the Liberals are now forced to concede, that even the Liberals are now forced to accept. So Listen, what's going to happen in the future with this, I don't know. The government is trying to do all of these little tiny tweaks and turn the dials and all of that to say, well, international students, we're going to cap this number here. But really, that is not dealing with the essence of the problem. That's not dealing with the core dynamic here. That's not dealing with what Canadians are dealing with in Canadian communities. And by the way, universities and colleges have been the ones that for years have loved looking at international students as being this giant cash cow, because a domestic student who's from Canada will pay, I don't know, $7,000 a year in tuition. And then you get these international students that are paying upwards of $50,000, $60,000. And the universities love it. And they have lowered their standards to make this happen. And it's Canada and Canadians that have suffered. And it's, by the way, the students themselves who are suffering. Because when the students come and they can't afford a place to live, they can't afford, they can't find a job, they actually are not able to devote what they need to their studies, because they're focused on just trying to deal with this bill of goods they've been sold, which is not what the country has offered them. So no, in fact, the most pro-immigrant position you could take on this is to say that Canada has profoundly failed on this. So we'll talk about this more tomorrow. Like I said, this was a fresh admission from Justin Trudeau just this morning, in fact. But to return to where we started yesterday, the big carbon tax demonstrations took place across the country. Chris Sims is the Alberta director for the Canadian Taxpayers Federation. She joins us every Monday, but we bumped it back with yesterday being a holiday at True North. And Chris, always good to talk to you. You've been very good at not letting the Alberta government off the hook here, because just as the federal carbon tax went up yesterday, so too did the reinstated Alberta fuel tax. And I've got to say, I mean, I've got a lot of time for Danielle Smith. You and I have both crossed paths with her many times over the years. I've yet to hear a compelling reason for why all of the things she's saying about the federal government don't apply to her government and the gas tax.
Yeah, same here. In fact, I was almost tempted to phone you about it just offline because I'm stumped. It's one of those weird situations where she's such a rock star when she's taking on Prime Minister Justin Trudeau. She went right into the lion's den there in Ottawa and did a great presentation at committee. And so, like, she's absolutely right to take the Trudeau government to task and say, scrap this carbon tax altogether. It's a huge waste of money. But then, like, puzzlingly, in Edmonton, here at home in Alberta, we got our fuel tax, a provincial fuel tax, increased all the way back up to its full strength of 13 cents per liter of gasoline and diesel. And to your point exactly, like, this is nothing personal. Big fan of a lot of what Premier Smith is doing. But policy-wise, I can't square this circle. This does not make any sense, both from a fiscal standpoint or from a communication standpoint. Fiscally, they did the right thing when they fully suspended the fuel tax here in Alberta for a year, Andrew. It saved Albertans around $1 billion, having it at zero for an entire year. Then they brought it back up to 9 cents per liter just at the new year, the start of 2024. But then they went all the way just yesterday and brought it all the way back up to 13. And so this is strange that they're doing this, considering the fact that they have a balanced budget and there's still places for them to cut. Like, why are they handing mega millions of dollars to an NHL team to help them build their hockey rink in Calgary while you're nailing drivers of everyday, you know, jobs here in Alberta for filling up their vehicles? And just communications wise, I don't get this part. Why would they bigfoot their own victory party? Why would they overlap their provincial fuel tax increase with big bad Justin Trudeau's carbon tax increase? Just comms wise, I don't even understand this play. Why not leave it at 9 cents per liter and kick the can ahead to June or July?
There's this old line that you hear that there is just one taxpayer, and yes, that federal spending, provincial spending, municipal spending, at the end of the day, when it's, you have one pocket, and when that $1 you've earned comes out of your pocket and goes to government in the abstract and in the grand sense, it really doesn't matter which one. I mean, I used to like Jack Astor's back in the day before the HST in Ontario. They used to have the line items on the receipt that you'd get. It was like Chrétien's tax and Dalton's tax. And then it was like Harper's tax and Wynne's tax. And I liked it, actually, because, you know, it told you, yeah, okay, they both have a role to play. But at the end of the day, the HST was a transparent policy because a tax is a tax is a tax. And this is the thing. I mean, to try to distinguish between these two is just from a messaging perspective alone flawed. But also, it means that any criticism she's making to the federal government, criticisms with which I agree,
yes,
can also be pointed back at her government. And I just don't get that. I mean, she's been asked about it somewhat. Have you gotten a sense of how she rationalizes it, at least?
I haven't heard her direct response many times, to be fair. And I'd like to hear it, frankly. Again, it was her birthday yesterday. I like so much of what she is doing. To be totally fair, they've balanced the budget here, Andrew. They wrote it into law that they must keep spending increases restrained below the rate of inflation plus population growth. They're paying down the debt. They're putting money away for a rainy day. Like, those are really good things. But it just pains me when they turn around and do nonsensical things like jacking up the fuel tax back up to full strength. And I can hear some people right now within the UCP saying, well, technically, you know, a barrel of oil is getting up there in price. Okay, fair enough. When former Premier Jason Kenney first announced this policy, yes, it was tied to the price of a barrel of oil. Once the price of a barrel of oil got up to, I think it's $90 per ton, $90 per barrel rather, they would then drop the fuel tax back down. But it was not getting to that range when Premier Smith, new Premier Smith, fully dropped it down to zero for a year. She did so for affordability reasons, and also to take some of the sting out of the federal carbon tax. And this is where I think, you know what, this is my hunch. I don't know for sure. I think what's happened is what's often called dome disease in Alberta. And that's where a politician who's elected really grassrootsy, very connected to the average person, gets put into office there in Edmonton. And then the bureaucrats who work in the Department of the Treasury Board, they get in there. And those types who don't run for election, they don't need to talk to average voters, they love trying to find new taxes. It's those sorts of pointy heads that keep suggesting a PST here in Alberta, for example, or new fees on all sorts of stuff so they can take in more money. Because those folks are always looking at that revenue column, how much money government's taking in. Fair enough. But politicians need to stand up to these people and say, you know what? No, read the room. We're not going to increase taxes. And when you combine it, Andrew, with just, I think it's just this morning, where NDP Premier of Manitoba, Wab Canoe, came out and said, yeah, I'm extending my fuel tax holiday. So folks in Manitoba are saving 14 cents per liter of gasoline and diesel. Zero. They're paying zero provincial fuel taxes in Manitoba. We got full freight 13. I don't understand.
There's a great quote from Milton Friedman, which is, to be honest, I don't love the, I like my version of the quote better because his is like more clinical in nature. But the effective meaning of it is that you shouldn't try to elect the right people. You should try to create the circumstances where even the wrong people do the right things, which naturally leads us to Manitoba, which has an NDP government, which has not been great on the carbon tax. They've not been terrible. They've been very wishy-washy. But even in Manitoba, their government is extending this fuel tax holiday.
That's right. And I've always loved that modified quote you use because it actually gives people a lot of hope, even outside of taxes. So everything that's gone on the past 4 or 5 years or whatever, it can get people down pretty fast. And I really like that method and that way of looking at it. I remember you telling me that years ago and it cheered me right up because then that means that we can fix stuff. We can create the conditions where even politicians who are, you know, lukewarm still nonetheless do the right thing. And in this case in Manitoba, again, no knock on Wab Canoe. He seems like a very personable person, actually. They've, I guess, created the conditions where they're doing the right thing. And so we're really happy to see that. And strangely, this is where things are a little bit Twilight Zone. Here in Alberta, we're even seeing some of the NDP candidates for the provincial party, because former Premier Rachel Notley is stepping down, they're having an NDP leadership race. Some of the NDP candidates have come out and said, yeah, we need to scrap the federal carbon tax. Now, there's a lot of asterisks around there. Mm-hmm. So I don't know how they feel about a provincial one. I don't know what kind of terminology they're going to use. But even to have them saying out loud with their face, we're opposed to the carbon tax, is huge. So this is a big game changer. And so again, it would be really nice to be able to just full throat approve of what the Alberta government is doing when they're rallying cry against the federal carbon tax. But it's really tough to do so when just cost-wise, straight up math, we are now paying higher taxes at the fuel pump.
I have to take a bit of an indulgence here, Chris. Did you listen to the song I sent you?
I have chance to yet.
So, okay, we're gonna do this now. So, okay. I admittedly I sent it, and Chris thought I was like Chris thought I'd been hacked and was like phishing her or something.
I did. I totally thought you'd been hacked. I'm like,
and then I looked because I was like, she always responds to me within like 5 seconds. Then I went and looked at the email. Like, oh yeah, this looks like a spam email. It's like, hey, check out this AI generated song. Anyway, so last week I discovered this AI song machine. Okay. And I was like, and I was just having some fun with it. And Chris has just been such a wonderful fixture on the show. We thought she needed her own theme song for the show. Let's roll it.
In the land of oil and cattle, there's a woman named Chris Sim.
Oh my
She's
God.
Got a fire in her heart, fighting against the government's whims. She ain't afraid to speak her mind. Stand up for what's right. A voice for the common folk. She's a beacon shining bright. She's crusading against taxes.
You are.
For the hardworking folks out there. She believes in limited government, in freedom she declares. With a heart full of passion and a spirit unyielding, Chris Sims is the voice. Her message is appealing.
Oh, there
Chris
we go.
Sims, you're the voice of Alberta in a world politics.
All right, we can end it there, Sean.
That is so nice. Thank you,
Chris
so
Sims,
much.
You're the voice of Alberta, and we're so glad you spend a little bit of your week with us. Keep up the great work. Keep up the fight. This is what happens when you don't open my emails. You miss out on...
I suddenly love something AI made. This is wonderful. You know, there's always room for growth. That's really touching. Thank you for that.
Yeah. So my wife has very little tolerance for AI generated anything. So like, she was like, stop sending me your freaking song. So I'm like, all right, well, I guess I just have to share them with the audience now. I think I'm done for now. I might make a couple of more. Sean was upset that he didn't have one. So I had a nice jazz song written about him needing to back off and let me do the AI song. So it actually slapped. As the kids say these days. So, all right. Well, Chris Sims, we will talk to you next week. Thank you so much for coming on, as always.
That was lit. Thanks, Andrew.
All right. Lit. Oh, we're going totally trendy today. We have lit and slapped, and we're based, I believe. Based AF, I think is it. Never mind. All right. I've never once in my life claimed to be cool, and I don't feel it will work out well for me if I try to start now. This is a fascinating, fascinating topic. I mean, look, the protests that we had yesterday were not massive. They weren't Freedom Convoy massive. They certainly weren't as tense as the Israel-Palestine protest. But even so, you had thousands of people out, in some cases in very cold and windy weather, that were mobilized by this issue. Now, Pierre Poilievre, he's been holding his rallies across the country. He has decided to, of all the issues he could talk about, he has decided to make the centerpiece of these rallies his pledge to axe the tax or spike the hike, whatever he calls it on a given day. But this is important because that is bringing people out. So this is going to be a mobilizing issue, just as housing is. The federal government, I said a few moments ago, has now finally admitted that there was a bit too much immigration for Canada to absorb. The housing dilemma has been one of the more pressing and acute symptoms of this. It's why Pierre Poilievre, again, has made housing so front and center on his policies. But every now and then, when you look around and see that homes are unaffordable, that not enough houses are being built, you wonder what the problem is. Now, there is a federally appointed housing advocate that believes we need to look at perhaps racism and white supremacy, systemic racism, all of these things. Not so, says Peter Sean Taylor, who is a senior features editor with C2C Journal, had a fantastic essay, "The Housing Market Isn't Racist. Blame Your Parents Instead." Peter, it's good to talk to you. Thanks for coming on the show today.
It's great to be here. Thanks for having me, Andrew.
So let's start with the premise, because I'm increasingly of the mind that you could probably find someone somewhere in the world that has said anything is racist. But this actually appears to have had some relative mainstream pickup here, this idea that the housing sector, the housing system is somehow racist. Where does this come from?
Well, as you said, this comes from the federal housing advocate, which was set up 2 years ago by the Trudeau government, supposedly to give advice to the federal government on housing issues. But anyone who has read any of the output that comes from the FHA It is the worst possible advice for anyone who wants to increase the supply of housing, which is what we absolutely need to do if we're going to make housing more affordable in Canada. Instead, this Marie-Josée Uhl, who's the federal housing advocate, she goes on things like, she's very concerned about what she calls the financialization of the housing market, which is in effect that it actually is a market. You have suppliers providing housing to people who demand it, and in the process they make a profit. That's how they continue to offer housing to people that want it. She wants to get rid of profit making from housing. She thinks it's somehow immoral. She wants to basically prevent all landlords from ever evicting tenants for anything like non-payment of rent. It just goes on and on. I could go at length. But the thing that sort of got my dander up this time around was her claim that the housing market is racist and that the federal government has to step in with some very drastic measures, such as banning banks and pension funds from lending money to for-profit housing providers. I could go on. We could do the whole segment on the stupid ideas that come out of the federal housing advocate. The point with my piece was that her claim that it's racist and that we need to take dramatic action. So I think that it's you hear everything is racist. As you said, the education system is racist, the employment system is racist, on and on and on. So they make a specific claim that the housing market is racist. They don't really back it up with any data. And as a matter of fact, Statistics Canada has been spending a lot of time since the Trudeau government came to power looking at race and a variety of issues. They have quite a few studies on housing and race. And so I took a look at it. And if you read the essay I wrote, there's no apparent white supremacy going on in the housing market. Yes, housing outcomes do seem to vary by racial background. You get a very distinct sort of racial leaderboard, but by no means are whites at the top. If the housing market was somehow controlled by white supremacists, or there was this evil racist plot behind renting and selling homes, then you would expect the whites to be at the top. In fact, they aren't. They're in the middle. It's Chinese and Japanese Canadians are at the very top. Asians more generally are up there as well. Whites are kind of in the middle, and at the bottom you see Blacks and Latin Americans, according to this is what Stats Can has to say. So that, you know, on the surface, that doesn't suggest to me that the housing market is racist. Its outcomes do vary, but that doesn't mean racism is behind it.
Well, and I would suspect that a lot of this is reflecting other divides that exist in other areas that have nothing to do with housing. One would be just general income divides. And again, I think if we want to have a discussion about racial divides on income, I think that's an important discussion. I also suspect geography probably plays a big role. I mean, if you look at the communities that have the most highly concentrated ethnic communities, they are generally speaking in urban centers, which happen to be the most expensive places in Canada to live, which is also a great contributor, I would assume. So again, where does she say the white supremacy is in all of this?
Well, the disappointing thing about her argument is that the federal housing advocate says a lot, says it very loudly and convincingly, but they don't provide very much
I'm glad it's not just me, because I read through your piece a number of times and I looked up elsewhere and I couldn't even find the point that you were. I knew you were refuting a valid point that was, or a point that was legitimately made, but I couldn't actually find like what was there to attack, really. That was the problem, because there was such a thin or non-existent basis for
it. A lot of vague accusations. Yeah. Another report they put out claims there should be reparations for past housing injustices. But to tackle the bigger question, perhaps, since the Trudeau government set up Stats Can to look at racial statistics and gender statistics, there's a whole sort of subunit at Stats Can now. That's supposed to be sort of investigating these sorts of things. And sure enough, when they look at employment, when they look at education, when they look at poverty figures, when they look at housing, You do see a very distinct, as I called it, a racial leaderboard. You tend to see Chinese, Japanese, Asian, Canadians at the top of whatever it is you're studying. Whites tend to be in the middle, and Blacks and Latin Americans tend to be towards the bottom, whether, as I said, all these different categories. So it does require some sort of explanation, as you say. The one that's sort of off the cuff these days is that it's all to do with racism. But I think as you look a little closer, you discover that there's other factors going on. And a lot of these factors, quite frankly, aren't within the control of government. These are family and individual choice decisions that, are going to be cultural norm issues as well that really require much more a broader sort of social response.
So explain to me the dangers of this, because it's easy to look at this sort of and roll your eyes and say, oh, well, but this is not just some, you know, wacky professor. This is not just some campus activist. This is someone who has a role that is designed to have a fair bit of influence in federal housing policy.
Right. I mean, she's set up to give the federal government advice on housing. And if the government is listening to the kind of advice that the federal housing advocate is providing, we're doomed. There's no question, because the goal here is to eliminate or reduce as much as possible the private sector from the provision of housing in Canada. And there's simply no way that can survive. There's this the racism report that I mentioned, one of its suggestions is that banks and pension funds be banned from lending money to anyone that makes a profit in the housing market. Now, just roll that around in your head for a little while. Beyond eliminating the mortgages for anyone who wants to rent out a house, it would completely destroy the bridge financing and short-term financing requirements for building large apartment buildings and complexes and all sorts of things. It would bring the entire construction industry to a complete halt. And their goal is to have nonprofits and co-ops fill the gap here. It's completely illogical, and there's no evidence that you can point to anywhere that the billions, if not trillions, of dollars of capital that you would require for getting Canada to where we need to be in terms of housing supply can be provided by the nonprofit sector. It's a complete fantasy.
No, and look, I always have this argument with people at the municipal level. It's easy to give developers it's easy to be mean about developers. Let's be real. I mean, a lot of them, people tend to view them as like the Sherman Potter character in It's a Wonderful Life. But the reality is, developers have a profit motive, but it is that motive that gets them building houses. And without that, you have to basically bureaucratize this process. And I don't think anyone who's ever relied on government for anything says that it can be known for running things efficiently or swiftly. So this idea that we need to take the capitalism out of the housing market is would just be economically catastrophic.
True. And also, it doesn't logically flow that someone who's interested in making a profit is going to be discriminatory.
The opposite, really. It's like, yeah, I know. Latino, I don't care. If you want to pay for my house, here you go.
And the bigger the company, the more routinized and the more processes they're going to have. I mean, if there was racism in the housing industry, you'd expect it to be someone whose personal prejudices can influence the room they rent in the basement, for instance. You're a big apartment building owner, REITs. I mean, another thing that just to go off on a side note, that the federal housing advocate is really worked up about are REITs and the fact that they get a particular kind of tax concession in Canada. Anyways, these big corporate entities that have thousands, if not tens of thousands of rental units to offer, they've got, you know, online forms and all sorts of processes and, you know, checking your bank records, et cetera, but they don't care what your race is. There's not even a category to check off on their application forms. These are the least racist organizations you could imagine. They just want to fill their apartments. So yeah, the underlying premise is crazy. And the outcomes that would result from the Federal Housing Advocates' suggestions would be devastating. And it's also, again, unfair to claim that Canada is riven by racism without providing any proof. Just to get back to my piece, all these StatsCan studies that come up and they keep showing this very particular racial leaderboard, rather than racism, a much more believable and credible reason for this is actually the rate of single parent households. And this can be a difficult topic to discuss, but Chinese Canadians have very low rates of single parenthood. Whites tend to have a medium sort of rate, and Blacks, quite frankly, have a very high rate of lone parent, especially lone mother households. And this has a big impact on the outcome of children and future generations. And as I said, it's not really within the ambit of the government to fix that. And I think that explains not all, but it's probably explains quite a bit of all these variations we see across racial backgrounds.
It is definitely a piece people should read. You'll get a lot more. If you're going to read two pieces on this, you can look at the housing minister's comments or the housing advocate's comments on this, but you'll need a palate cleanser immediately after that. So go to Peter Sean Taylor's piece, "The Housing Market Isn't Racist. Blame Your Parents Instead." Peter, good to talk to you again. Thanks for coming on today.
It was a pleasure. Thanks for having me.
All right. Thank you. I meant to talk about this earlier on the weekend. It was Easter, or if you are with the federal government, it was not. It was actually, let's just put up this tweet from Veterans Affairs Canada. I can't even see it. There we go. "We want to wish veterans, current members of the Canadian Forces and RCMP and their families a happy March holiday season." And what do you do to celebrate the March holiday season? You make Easter colored deviled eggs, it appears. Now, I'm just offended that people are serving deviled eggs in any format, but actually they're veterans. Maybe they're just using them as weapons. But the fact that we call this the March holiday season instead of Easter is a little bit baffling to me. Now, the day earlier, Justin Trudeau had, or the day before Good Friday, I should say, Justin Trudeau wished people a happy Ramadan on Good Friday. He had nothing to say at all. Veterans Affairs, I'm filing tomorrow an access to information request. I want to wait a couple days because I want to see if they like, because every now and then, if you file one after the fact, you will catch in the ATIP the things they said about you criticizing them. So I want to just give a little bit of the fallout from this, an opportunity to be caught in this, but this is what it's come to now. You can't even say Easter. It's a happy March holiday season. Now, I think they did eventually do an Easter post, probably when they saw, there we go, when they saw everyone being dragged. See, those eggs are non-deviled, so they're a less offensive egg to celebrate Easter with. In any event, that does it for us for today. We will be back tomorrow with more of Canada's most irreverent talk show here on The Andrew Lawton Show on True North. Thank you, God bless, and good day to you all.
Thanks for listening to The Andrew Lawton Show. Support the program by donating to True North at www.tnc.news.